No, we won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No.
Welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. I have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, I'll start the show with Yuri Rashkin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Then I'll be speaking with Jesse Reed, who is running for Waukesha County Clerk, against Kathy Nicholas. I will finish the hour with Brian Austin, who is a blogger from Cops for Labor, and he's also a police officer in Wisconsin. We're going to be talking about the Castle Doctrine in Wisconsin, which is the law that allowed Bo Morrison to be killed. In the second hour, I will start off the hour with Mike Brown from One Wisconsin Now. He's going to talk about the money raised in the recalls and our favorite think tank, ALEC. And I will finish out the show with Scott Wakeoff from Badger Democracy. The phone numbers are 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. If you have any questions or comments, I also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com where you can post all your questions or comments as well. Now, a quick announcement. Wisconsin's Unite Against the War on Women protest is a rally scheduled for the afternoon of April 28th in Madison, Wisconsin. This rally is part of a coordinated nationwide series of events to march and rally against the war on women. The following are confirmed speakers: Chris Taylor, she's at the MC and she's from Wisconsin Assembly; Mark Pocan, who is also from the Wisconsin Assembly and a candidate for Congress; Kelda Helen Royce, again, Wisconsin Assembly and a candidate for Congress. Both of them are running for the 2nd CD. And, of course, Yuri Rashkin from the Janesville City Council and candidate for the 34th Assembly District. He'll correct me when he comes on in a second if I didn't get that right. Of course, they have the Raging Grannies and much more. If you want to know more about the Wisconsin Unite Women, go to www.unitewomenwi.org. Now, with that, I'd like to welcome Yuri Rashkin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Good morning, Yuri. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, Sarah. It's the 44th district. But that's perfectly all right, because if you're in Janesville, you know where you are, and that's all that matters for that particular number.
I was trying to pull it out of my memory. I apologize about that. At least I got one of the numbers right. I got the 4 right. I'm like, I know there's a 4 in there.
That's right. Oh, my gosh. What a week. We have a lot of exciting news developments. I'm really glad you mentioned the Unite Against the War on Women rally, because just as it's coming up, it's getting bigger and bigger. And according to Facebook, there's only 656 people going, but I bet there's more that are going to be there. I have a feeling it's going to be a pretty big one. So I think that's going to be a fun rally. And considering the kind of amazing weather we've been having, and just about regardless, I think this could be something very special, and I'm really looking forward to it. I have no idea how I ended up on this rock star lineup, but it's going to be great, and I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Well, I'm looking forward to being there as well, and I'm looking forward to hearing you speak. And I mean, there's more speakers than just that. I just picked out a couple of the main ones, but they have a list, and it's really going to be an amazing march and rally.
Yep. And you know, it's really important, because it's kind of morphing from an accident to a pattern to a strategy, and frankly, I'm trying to understand why in the world a political party would decide that picking on the majority of voters, which women are, is a smart thing to do politically, besides just the fact that it makes them look bizarre and, the kind of society we live in where it's a two-party system, you have people kind of saying, if I'm a Republican, then I guess I have to support things the Republicans say. And all of a sudden, there's this support for this language and these ideas that seemed outdated for the last 40 years, if not 100 years. And you have people saying, well, yeah, it makes sense. Well, you know, I don't know any successful women who are supporting this war on women. Or, you know, it's just bizarre language out there. And it's hard sometimes to even understand where it's coming from. But it is very much out there. And it's like somebody took a lid off of this craziness, and it's just coming out of like this genie out of a bottle, and we gotta speak up and stand up, because it's just not acceptable.
Well, even the Republican women, some of them who voted for this stuff, are standing up and going, oh, I think you guys got a little too far.
Yes, and in fact, why I wanted to start this week is we have New York Times, the opinion pages editorial that came out on April 11th, comes out and starts by really kind of hitting back at Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin, saying that, you know, he's struggling to fight off a determined effort to replace him in a recall election, and yet he gives every 2 weeks a new reason to recall him. It's really interesting because when I talk to some of the older Dems, they go, well, you know, we beat him, you know, we showed him in the recalls and last summer, and now the Republicans are going to stay quieter. And no, these guys don't stay quiet. They always double down. They go further. They get louder. It doesn't make any logical sense, but they just feel like that's the right thing to do. So just as you think we showed him, we taught them a lesson, nope. He signs a repeal of a 2009 law allowing the victims of wage discrimination to pursue damages in state court. And, you know, it says that at the time the law was passed, women earned an average of 75 cents for every dollar men earned. By 2010, after the law passed, the average woman had edged up to about 78 cents. Well, now it's being pushed back. And, of course, the reasoning being, well, we don't want to feed the lawyers, which is bizarre. It's kind of like saying we don't want to feed the doctors, because they just make all the money when you go to the hospital. It's bizarre logic, and hopefully the voters will send a message that we're just not going to buy that kind of stuff.
Well, it is very bizarre logic, considering, what, more than half the constituency is women?
Right.
And I guess anything to try to make it more palatable for anyone to accept, but they're really... If you're a woman, it's really hard to see it any other way than taking away the rights that you've earned and that you should have.
Well, and you're always, you know, there's always the logic in politics that you need that scapegoat. And I'm just talking about the kind of the nuts and bolts, the sausage-making part of this, where you find a small group that you pick on. And but it's like, what kind of an idiot would pick on 54% of the electorate?
Apparently the entire GOP party.
I mean, come on.
What did they think that was just going to pass by? The women would be like, oh, you're taking away our birth control and you're taking away our equal pay? Sure, go right ahead. We're okay with that. Did they just think it would just slide by, or we would just be like, you know, we got too much to worry about, we just won't worry about that?
And, you know, and that's what I'm trying to understand. What is the logic here? Because I see the effects. It doesn't make any sense what they're saying. But there's got to be some ideologue somewhere that thought, we're going to win elections this way. This is great. And, I, you know, there isn't enough old white men to vote for this kind of crap. So I'm really trying to understand who thought this was a good idea. But nonetheless, we have these bizarre laws that now we need to repeal. Now we need to make sure that we win elections just so that we don't roll back in time. You know, we need the time machine when you have Scott Walker.
Well, maybe they're expecting to take away our voting rights, too, and that it's only rich white landowners again or something, and then that would be okay. They would pass that if it was only rich white landowners voting, but that's not the case. Women vote. Yeah, no kidding. Women vote, and I have to tell you, I don't see a lot of happy women in regards to this. But these
No matter what, exactly, no matter what party, it doesn't make sense, because when you tell somebody that you're going to take away their rights, you're never going to get somebody who say, that's a great idea. I mean, that's just not how people are built. So that's what I'm saying. It is such, besides being a bizarre idea, it is such dumb policymaking. Enough of that. We have, you know, we're going to have a rally. We're going to have elections. And hopefully all of that is going to send a strong enough message that we're going to get that line of thinking kicked back into the dark ages and not worry about it for a while.
Ever.
In the meantime, we have, exactly.
Ever again.
Well, you know, I'm being an optimist for a while.
Oh.
Governor Scott Walker, in the meantime, has said that while state agencies under his control are, you know, he says that we're not going to award marriage pay to anyone. But then we have Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, who says, well, I'm going to give about $300,000 in bonuses to about 93 employees, which is ending up to about $3,100 per person that he's going to give out in bonuses. And this is where we have another example of Scott Walker shifting, passing the buck, because he says, well, this is not my agency. He's separate, you know, like Tony Evers decided to give out bonuses. I can't do anything about that. Well, okay, sure, you know, you can kind of buy it for a second, but then you look at history and you see the discretionary merit pay was discontinued by Governor Doyle in 2008. And then Walker revived it effective March 11th of this year. So first he creates these new rules that allow this kind of abuse, or at least behavior, and then he said, well, I can't control it when somebody else does it. You know, you can't have it both ways.
But he tries.
And he'll tell it to you over and over, hoping that you'll believe it.
Or maybe eventually he will.
You know, I thought about that, and it doesn't even really matter what he believes, because what he says and what he does is clear enough that even if he believes nothing of what he does and supports nothing of what he does, then it's the effect is still there, and he shouldn't be doing the job. Which I suppose it would be a good time to bring up my little a joke page that I launched less than a week ago, really, because we have this discussion on the left of who should run against Scott Walker. And I'm sure you've been a part of it and you've engaged, because everybody has. Is this candidate better? Is this candidate better? But the problem is that these discussions get heated because people are very passionate. And before too long, you have people who are saying, well, if my candidate doesn't get the nomination, by golly, I'm just not going to vote because the other one is so bad. And I kind of took a step back and went, hello, this is not a regular election. It just isn't. We're looking at a recall election, so it's really quite simple. Are you for Scott Walker or are you against him? It's really just that simple. And, of course, it's what Scott Walker would want you to do is to start looking at the other side and evaluate them carefully. And, of course, nobody's perfect, and that creates some confusion. So I thought, well, let's fight this negativity and confusion with some humor and clarity. And so I launched a Facebook page it's called Empty Can of Beer for Governor of Wisconsin, because it will do less damage. And now we have over 200 fans of this page, and we have photos, all of which were submitted by fans, that are showing the Empty Can of Beer campaigning for governorship. It's been, you know, the jokes are writing themselves, and it's been a lot of fun. So it's just a kind of a way to remind to people that it's about the recall. It's not about the can of beer. It's not about any of the fine candidates we have running. It's about Scott Walker. Either you support him or you do not.
What do you, Yuri, what do you think about the fake Dems?
I think that this is an interesting discussion, because we now have somebody on our side that is running against Scott Walker in the Republican primary. But while I think on the right, I think it's very obvious that those people are violating whatever rules there are, if not laws, but we'll leave that for the attorneys to decide and judges, because when you're supposed to support the party that you're representing, and you're supposed to represent the party's ideals, and yet these people say, well, yes, we are fake Democrats, yes, we're doing this to slow the recall down, yes, we're doing this to help Scott Walker, I think this is pretty obvious. That's not what the primary is designed for, and there sounds like there's some laws written to prevent this kind of seeming abuse. On the other hand, we have my good friend, Arthur Coleriggs, who is running as a Lincoln Republican in the Republican primary, and I think on some level he makes a very good point, which is that he is the real Republican, because if you look at the tenets of Republican Party of supporting individual liberties and all sorts of good things that at some point Republican Party, I thought, stood for, Scott Walker doesn't even really represent that. So to give him some reason to remind his own voters why he is a real Republican, I think makes all the sense in the world for me. And I think it makes sense. But on the other hand, I'm sure there's going to be people on the right who are going to say that art is just as much of a fake as the other ones. And unfortunately, that's you know, fortunately or unfortunately, that's what democracy is all about. And that's why we have laws, and that's why we have attorneys and judges, and it's going to get sorted out. But my goodness, I guess in the end, I just come down to it. I'm glad we live in a free country where we can exercise our freedoms and we can vote.
Yes, I'm glad we do too. And it just, yeah. And unfortunately, I don't see Wisconsin being that free anymore, whereas it used to be with all the laws that they've passed. That seems to curtail the democracy. But I find it interesting,
Sarah. You're a woman. You can still vote. What's your problem?
I know. What am I thinking? Thank goodness they didn't take that away from me. Gosh, I'm thrilled. Wow. Yeah. Well, what I find interesting is that Levinson, he's an attorney, wrote a complaint to the GAB. We're going to talk about this later with one of our guests. And he said that it's actually breaking state statutes for running, I think it's 12.3A, I think it's a state statute, because it's actually falsifying information that could change the course of an election. So it's interesting to see how that's going to play out. Now,
it's very interesting. Yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, we're pretty much out of time. I know you've got to get going, and Jesse's waiting patiently on the phone. So what's coming up this coming week? What do you see coming down the pipe?
The last story that I really wanted to mention is that we have a wonderful event of ALEC falling apart, with all sorts of large corporate sponsors exiting and heading for the door because they decided that it just wasn't a good idea anymore to be associated with the American Legislative Exchange Council. And that group now includes Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Mars, Kraft Foods, McDonald's, Wendy's, Intuit, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation said that it won't give ALEC any more grants. I mean, this is really good stuff. It's really nice that putting pressure on people and exposing them for the horrible things that they do to really our states and our country, you know, has some repercussions. So, you know, we did good.
I'm actually excited to see that. I'm very excited that this little shadow organization is now coming out and being held responsible for the stuff that they're doing.
Exactly. So you have a wonderful show, and I look forward to talking with you next week.
Have a great week, Yuri. Thank you so much for being on.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, you too. Bye. That was Yuri Raskin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup, and we'll have a quick break. Coming up next will be Jesse Reed, who is running for Waukesha County Clerk.
Hi, this is Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, a free podcast that you can subscribe to on iTunes. Last weekend, Governor Scott Walker continued the GOP's war on women by quietly signing several pieces of anti-woman legislation. Among these bills were a ban on abortion coverage, except in cases of rape, incest, or medical necessity, as well as a bill that forces women seeking an abortion to go through private consultation with a doctor apart from friends or family, adding more stress to a tough situation. An abortion is a dramatic choice that is not only hard to make, but also hard to live with for many women after the fact. This law goes as far as to charge doctors with a felony should they not comply. And finally, Walker signed a repeal of Wisconsin's 2009 Equal Pay for Equal Work law. Some members of the Republican legislature said that money is more important for men than it is for women. One must ask themselves, when Scott Walker is facing a historic recall election, why would he attack 52% of our population? Even the president admitted that he will have more freedom after the election. Several weeks ago, Walker said the governorship was not that important to him and that his wife would love if he went back to the private sector to make, quote, some real money. Is it possible that Walker is actually asking us to recall him? Perhaps he has reached the conclusion that governing an entire state is just a little too much for a college dropout to handle. Maybe he is just trying to give us that extra push. I'm Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, because it's essential for democracy.
You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz, and on now is Jesse Reed. She is running for Waukesha County Clerk against the infamous Kathy Nicholas. Good morning, Jesse. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah. How are you this morning?
I am doing well. I have... Just a side note, it has nothing to do with anything. I just thought I'd bring it up. I'm drinking new coffee, and for some reason it has an aftertaste of chicken. And I'm not sure if I'm appreciating it or not this morning. So,
well, I've got hazelnuts in my coffee. So,
I'm sure it doesn't leave an aftertaste of chicken. So why are you running for county clerk in Waukesha? What brought you to want to do that?
Well, I've never been politically active before last year, and I just was put out by the fact that I didn't think my vote was being counted properly. That was the first thing that really got my attention. And then I was talking with some friends who said, well, you should run, you should run. So I started looking into it. I got some training, and that got me even more interested. But as I'm thinking about it, really, the main reason that I'm running right now is that I want to become a public servant. I want to serve the people of Waukesha County. Most of my career has been spent in service to customers and clients, and I just feel that this is the next step in my career. I would like to be able to bring integrity, bring competence back into this office, and serve the people of Waukesha County, not serving myself.
Now, the county clerks do a lot of work, a lot of thankless jobs, and you don't really don't hear about them unless there's a problem, which is why we all know about Kathy Nicholas.
Exactly.
So, but there's a lot that's entailed in that job. What's some of your background that would allow you to do that kind of job? Because there's elections, there's bookkeeping. I mean, just the list goes on.
Well, my background is accounting and bookkeeping. I have a master's in management, and my focus was on accounting. I've worked in accounting offices, and I've worked for a number of small businesses and nonprofit organizations, working in the offices primarily doing the bookkeeping and doing database work and things of that nature. I worked for 8 years in my church office as the office manager, and I was doing all kinds of things in that position. But also, I was treasurer at the time, and so I was doing all of the bookkeeping, plus doing a lot of desktop publishing and working with the database for the church. And currently, I am self-employed, and I'm working for churches again. I enjoy that position. I'm working for two different churches. Again, I'm working in terms of desktop publishing, getting out the bulletins and the newsletters, but also doing the finances part of it, putting in the contributions of the congregation and also paying the bills, and I'm also working with the databases. So I'm very familiar with that type of operation, keeping track of things and recording things, and that's been most of my career the whole time.
So you're in business and you're a progressive. That's pretty impressive. I don't hear about
I've got an accounting background, which is even makes me more of an oddball in some ways.
Well, how do you think, and I can't say anything that Kathy's in, a lot of it's all been alleged stuff that's happened in the county clerk office. How would you be able to bring integrity back into that office? How would you do that?
Well, I've worked in places where my word, my honesty is very important. When you're working in a church office, you just don't go in there to deceive or to work for yourself. You're there to serve the people. And I grew up in farm country in Indiana, and your word was the main thing. It was everything that you based on. And what I say, I mean. And that's how I feel like I'm going to bring integrity back to this office. I'm going to keep it open. I'm going to keep it transparent. I'm not going to let partisan politics play a role. And when I say I'm going to do something, I will do it. That's how I'm going to bring back integrity. And they can count on that because my word is good.
How have you been received in Waukesha County?
Actually, very well. Very well. I've been out trying to get out and meet people, and I've had a very good response to my candidacy. Everybody seems welcome and open to my running, both Republican and Democrat. So I think I've got a real shot at this.
So going back to bringing integrity back to the office, so if you make a mistake, you'll take responsibility for it and not blame others?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not saying that I will never make a mistake. That's just foolish talk. But if I make one, I will correct it and I will own up to it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that Waukesha County is accepting you. Going kind of jumping questions. I apologize about that, jumping forward. I was a little concerned, but then again, we also had one of, I believe, the county executive ask Kathy Nicholas to step down for the recount, the recall elections, both of them. So they're not, there's a lot of unhappy people, it seems like, in Waukesha County with her right now.
Well, I think there are. I can only speak for the few friends that I have at my church and at the churches that I work at who are Republican. They are for my campaign because they know that Kathy can't be trusted to follow through and make good on what she is supposed to be doing. And so I've got Republican support, and I just feel like I can do the job. I will get the training that's necessary. I'm working with the GAB, trying to get all the information that I can to make sure that I can do the job and do it with the best practices and procedures that are available.
Do you know if there's going to be a Republican primary for the county county clerks? And do you know if you're going to be primaried or not?
My understanding is, yes, there will be a Republican primary. To my knowledge, there are two other Republicans running also for this office against Kathy Nicholas. So there's be three in that primary, assuming that Kathy stays in there until then. To my knowledge, I am the only one, the only Democrat running.
Are you worried they're going to run a fake Dem against you?
No, not really. I doubt it because they're too busy running their own primary. So they probably figured that since it is a fairly Republican county that if they, whatever Republican they put up, they'll probably win, which I think is good for my campaign because I can run around unnoticed by them and do a lot of door knocking. I'm having a great time doing this, getting out and meeting people. This is a lot of fun, and I think that I can make inroads simply because I'm willing to go out there and meet the people.
Well, how has Kathy Nicholas hurt Waukesha's reputation? What have you heard about that through your friends on both sides?
Well, the thing is that she's an embarrassment. How is it that we are the only county in America that our county clerk is known nationally because of her screw-ups? I mean, that's just an embarrassment to everybody here at Waukesha, that we can't be assured that our votes are being counted and counted properly, no matter what your brand of partisanship. it's really it's made everybody upset and embarrassed by the whole situation. And this has not been going on just in the past year. On some research that I've done, almost from the beginning, there's been problems with elections and other things going on in this office that were really, quite honestly, beyond belief.
So have you had any problems with the right-wing sound machine from Milwaukee at all? Has anyone bothered you, or they just kind of left you be?
Not that I've heard. I don't think they're bothering with me, to be quite honest. Which is just fine by me.
I was going to say that.
If you hear anything, let me know.
I will pass it along, I promise.
Okay.
Now, have you had a lot of support from the local newspapers, The Patch, anything of that nature?
I have been in contact with them. They haven't reached out to me too much. They did right at the very, very beginning of my campaign, before I was even ready to start talking to anybody. I had a reporter or two wanting to know about me. But since then, I've been in contact with the Patch and with a couple of the local newspapers, and that after the recall election, I plan on putting up some flyers in the local newspapers and on the Patch and things like that, just to start getting my name out there.
And what kind of support do you need in your campaign?
Well,
what kind of support are you looking for?
First and foremost, I need your vote on November 6th, no matter what. That's probably the most important. Second, talk it up. Talk with your friends that live in Waukesha County. Let them know about me. I've got a website. My website is, if I may,
go right ahead.
It is read, READ, like read a book, read, the number 4, WaukeshaCountyClerk.com. So it's read 4, WaukeshaCountyClerk.com. And I've got a place on there. Of course, it does take some money to get my word out, getting the flyers printed and whatnot, and getting my name out there. So if you can go to How Can You Help on my webpage, I do have a PayPal button there.
But you can, all
any,
that
any little bit will help.
I was going to say, all of that can be on your website, right? So really,
yes,
if you want to help out, go to your website then, and you could check and see what she's got on the website as well. And there's ways to contact you on the website too?
Yes, there is. Uh-huh.
Okay. Wonderful. And that is read, number 4, WaukeshaCountyClerk.com.
That's right. And read is like read a book, READ.
Okay. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for being on the show today. Good luck with
thank
your
you.
Campaign and race. And hopefully you won't have any fake Dems running against you in August. And we'll see if we can get you back on again before November.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Well, thank you. Have a great day now.
Alrighty.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Jesse Reed, who is running for Waukesha County Clerk. And again, her website is readforwaukeshacountyclerk.com. Coming up next, Brian Austin with Cops for Labor. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Rogers and Nixon coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming. Forehead in Ohio. Forehead in Ohio. Forehead in Ohio. Forehead in Ohio.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. We are now speaking with Brian Austin, who is the blogger from Cops for Labor. Good morning, Brian. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Now, you had a great piece on the Castle Doctrine. Before you go into detail, I'm going to ask you to go into detail about the Castle Doctrine, but can you give a little bit of background on yourself?
Sure. I've been a police officer in Madison for 15 years. I'm currently a detective and also I'm on the SWAT team. I have a law degree from UW Law School and practice law primarily as a criminal prosecutor for about 4 years before I decided to become a police officer. And just to clarify, you know, as we talk today, I'm speaking on my own behalf and, you know, certainly don't represent my department in terms of what we're talking about, but that's kind of a little bit of my background and, you know, lived in Madison for, in the Madison area for going on 20 years now.
And you were part of the protest, weren't you? Weren't you down at the protest as well?
Yeah, I became involved very early on. I'm a member of our union's executive board, but really became very heavily involved in the protests last year, almost from day one. As you remember, our union and the fire unions across the state were exempt from this legislation, and you know, there was clearly an attempt by the government to divide labor, and it didn't work, and we came out very strongly against that. And it was really a kind of a transformative event in my life and has really led me into a lot of different areas in terms of activism and writing and things like that. And that's kind of what brought me to the Castle Doctrine piece.
Well, now, can you go into detail about what the Castle Doctrine is?
Yeah, Castle Doctrine is an area of law that's developed kind of based on traditional use of force and self-defense law. But it basically... under traditional use of force law, for a person to use deadly force against another human being, they had to demonstrate that they were in imminent danger. There was an imminent threat of death or great bodily harm. And great bodily harm has a specific definition in Wisconsin, but it's a serious bodily injury. There's some criteria for that threat to be imminent. You know, the person they use the force against has to have a weapon. They have to have the intent. And a weapon can be hands, but it just has to be something used as a weapon under the circumstances that could cause death. They have to have the intent to cause death or great bodily harm against a person who's defending themselves, and they have to have the means to do so. So this body of law, the Castle Doctrine, Stand Your Ground, body of law really takes away some of the requirements of the person using deadly force in self-defense to actually prove or even demonstrate that they were in reasonable fear of death or great bodily harm. Basically, the law has taken away that requirement and now presumes that if somebody is, for instance, in your home or coming to your home or, you know, on your property or at your back door or in your vehicle, that you are in imminent threat of death or great bodily harm, and therefore you're given pretty much blanket authorization to use that force.
Was this law actually something that was needed in Wisconsin?
No, and that's, you know, the tremendous couple of really striking things about these laws is, number one, there was no outpouring of demand by the general public. And that's really one of the most unsettling parts about all this, is this was not, you know, even if it was unpopular in some circles, you know, if there was a groundswell, you know, by a majority of the democratic process, perhaps, you know, it could be taken more seriously. But there really wasn't. This came from lobbying groups. And furthermore, Wisconsin law very clearly protected homeowners and other people who used deadly force against people who were attacking them. Wisconsin law provided those people a significant amount of protection. There was very, very established self-defense provisions that provided justification for the use of deadly force. So much so, I'm very familiar with this because it's exactly the laws that police officers rely upon to do their job. You know, as you know, society at times requires of us to use deadly force to protect members of the society and to protect ourselves as police officers. And police officers wouldn't be able to do that if there wasn't legal, you know, legal provisions that help protect us. And so there was a really, really established and very settled area of law that provided this protection. This was an unnecessary body of law, in my opinion.
And which lobbyists were really behind this? Who really pushed this type of law to go through?
Well, you know, it didn't get a lot of attention at the time. One of the most high-profile areas now, obviously, is the state of Florida. And the state of Florida, from what I could tell, really helped kick off this body of law across the country. But Jeb Bush signed the Stand Your Ground law in Florida into law in 2005. It was very clearly pushed by lobbyists from the NRA, the National Rifle Association. And, in fact, there's a pretty well-documented scene at the bill signing where there was an NRA lobbyist actually standing next to Jeb Bush as he signed this law. The interesting part about it is after the law was signed in Florida, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, took the Florida law and basically adopted it as their model law that they were going to now promote across the country. And that's exactly what they did. As you know, ALEC is this unholy alliance between corporate lobbyists and corporate interests and legislators. So they have a direct pipeline to legislators all over the country in the state houses. And they got these bills passed in about 24 different states. And Wisconsin is now, you know, one of the more recent states that has this Castle Doctrine law. So it started in one area and then just literally spread across the country.
So the Castle Doctrine came out of the Stand Your Law or Stand Your Ground law?
They're both very similar. They're called different things, and there's some slight, there's some variations between the laws. But the Castle Doctrine and Stand Your Ground laws are kind of it's certainly in the same classification, the same body of law that's come out of all of this.
Do you feel this law was pandering to a specific type of people, or that there are more nefarious underpinnings to this?
Well, you know, it really, and the Center for Media and Democracy has done a phenomenal job uncovering this link between, ALEC and all sorts of different facets of our society, but in particular the whole Castle Doctrine, Stand Your Ground body of law. You know, I was unaware of that link before the work they did, and as soon as I read about it, it really troubled me because I had to stop and say, why would a corporate lobbyist group, you know, a group that represents Kraft and Walmart and all these different large corporations, you know, multinational corporations, what possible interest could they have? Why would they care about these Stand Your Ground laws? And, you know, the first, I think the mainstream media has picked up on this somewhat thanks to the Center for Media and Democracy, but at times they get the story wrong, in my opinion. I think this goes beyond just selling more guns because, you know, Walmart is a part of ALEC, and Walmart's the largest retailer in the country of guns and ammunition. So, you know, the general mantra is, well, you know, they stand to make a profit. And I think there's more to it than that. When you look at what's been going on across this country, the dividing working people against each other, union, non-union, public employee, not public employee, you know, when you look at the state of our nation as we find it today, the highest income inequality in the entire Western, you know, industrialized world, and a disparity that's growing all the time, a society where people are really starting to suffer as a result, where wealth in the top 1% has tripled over the past three decades. I think that the people pushing these agendas have to look for new ways to divide people, because if people really united and woke up and saw what was occurring in this country, it would have to end, because people wouldn't tolerate it anymore. So I see, you know, some really troubling motivations here behind some of these laws that serve to really kind of dehumanize people, turn them against each other, and kind of make this kind of violence acceptable.
They've been actually pushed as a way to defend yourself. Do you feel that that's obviously a falsehood then in pushing that kind of ideology, since obviously it's already, you could already defend yourself and it was already booked in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. I mean, it's like passing an entire second set of driver's licensing laws. You already have the right to drive a car if you take the test. In Wisconsin, you already had the right to utilize deadly force. You had the right to kill somebody if you were in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm. You know, I think what has happened is the law has reduced that burden in terms of you really don't have to be in danger now if you are in your home. And, you know, as I wrote in my piece, you know, the law kind of takes away the requirement of even identifying whether you have a violent attacker coming to your house, or maybe your neighbor with Alzheimer's who happens to be back at the wrong door after their walk. You know, it's a very, very troubling distinction, you know, a troubling progression of the law. And I just think it's completely, completely unnecessary. And so there has to be another motivation behind it. And yes, there is the, you know, it's part of this shiny object campaign. You know, it's shifting the blame onto these, you know, unseen hordes of intruders that are looking to come into your house, instead of focusing on, you know, the financial industry that completely tanked our economy and has led to economic chaos in this country. So it's pretty unsettling when you delve into it.
All right, we're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back with Brian Austin. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Finally, George Zimmerman's been arrested. It's amazing it took so long. If the roles had been reversed, if Trayvon Martin had shot Zimmerman dead in the street, you can bet that Trayvon would have been arrested and charged right away, not 46 days later. And let's be clear here, the only reason Zimmerman ultimately got charged was because people at the grassroots, in the streets, on Facebook and Twitter, on Progressive Talk Radio, and on MSNBC, made a stink about it. Otherwise, it would have been just another case of racist law enforcement, of stand-your-ground injustice, of White Castle doctrine. Remember, it took a long while for the outrage to build. Trayvon Martin was killed way back on February 26th. Most Americans didn't start hearing about the case for almost a month. And had it not been for the outspokenness of Trayvon Martin's family and the help of Al Sharpton and the anger that every parent, and especially black parents, felt at this injustice, we may never have heard about this case at all. It's a case, though, much larger than Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. It's a case about race in America. And it's a case about the control of our state legislatures by anti-democratic forces like the NRA and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Whatever the outcome of Zimmerman's trial, the jury will still be out on the fate of our democracy. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show, and Brian Austin, who is the blogger for Cops for Labor. Now, Brian, can you talk about which of the Wisconsin politicians helped push this through? Who brought this bill up?
Well, I haven't really focused on a lot of the history in terms of, but this is really the amazing thing about the Republican Party in Wisconsin right now is just how lockstep they are, and how united they are in pushing through these ideals. So it almost becomes irrelevant in terms of the promoter of a particular legislation, because they're just so disciplined in their moving of this this type of legislation forward. And you saw that almost across the board with just a couple of notable exceptions like Senator Schultz and others. But, you know, it's really, you know, Alec is the person, you know, as Representative Pocan mentioned, it's Representative Alec that's in the room pushing these promotions, and it almost doesn't matter who the legislator is who promotes it. They're not written by legislators. They're not written by politicians. They're written by lobbyists and then passed on. You know, one thing I wanted to make clear, Sarah, and, you know, I think people are having a tough time at times wrapping their brains around hearing a police officer speak like I am. And, you know, I just want to make it clear, I have no problems with our traditional use of force law, and I have absolutely no problems with people protecting themselves, even using deadly force against, you know, people who are attempting to prey on them. We have people in our society who do prey upon other people, and at times it is necessary to defend yourself, particularly in your home. My only point is that there was already existing law that protects people from the legitimate use of deadly force. And what I don't want to see happen is we as a society become so desensitized and so violent that we take away the moral and ethical and legal requirements that used to exist to be able to take somebody's life.
Well, when you talk to your friends and fellow officers, where do you and they see American society?
Well, I think it's a society that's become more disconnected, and, you know, there's less a sense of community right now. And I think, again, that breakdown in the sense of community has actually been fostered by the corporate interests that dominate our society. You know, we have a state of our political system where it's completely and utterly bought and paid for through campaign contributions and unlimited political spending, and that has to change before anything will really truly change. But we're, you know, it's kind of, I think we're not witnessing a great point in our society. You know, you look at this country after World War II and the choices we made in terms of, you know, sending 25% of our population to college and the GI Bill and you know, making sure people had what they need and this, you know, sense of shared community and shared sacrifice and shared prosperity. And you're not seeing that right now. What you're seeing is, you know, promotion of this every person for himself attitude, winner takes all. If you're not doing well, it's because you haven't worked hard enough and you need to pull yourself up, when really the deck is kind of stacked. Now, certainly my view isn't shared by, I don't claim to speak for the law enforcement profession. It's a varied profession in terms of demographics and political persuasions and all that. What is very interesting, though, across the country is you're seeing police unions really starting to, and police organizations really starting to see that there is kind of a war being waged against workers' rights. And some of those wars in states like Ohio and others have directly affected police officers, and I think they're starting to see that especially the current GOP no longer represents their interests. And you are, I read an article where the president of the National Fraternal Order of Police was speaking to this very issue and just saying that the GOP really has turned its back on the police unions, who, you know, were traditionally somewhat conservative and supported more Republican candidates. Now, I never, you know, I can't claim to ever be in that camp. You know, I've always occupied kind of the left side of the equation. But, you know, what has happened in the past year has certainly opened my eyes a lot more as to what was occurring in this country.
Well, and the Castle Doctrine that was passed in Wisconsin wasn't as severe as some of the other Castle Doctrines across the country. Can you talk about, you mentioned two of them in particular in your blog. Can you mention those again?
Yeah, the most troubling one to me was Indiana. Wisconsin specifically exempts the Castle Doctrine from being utilized against law enforcement officers acting in an official capacity. Now, I don't take a lot of comfort in that exemption, because I think what the Castle Doctrine does is it really lowers people's inhibitions in using deadly force. And I think once you lower somebody's, you know, once you lower their requirement that they actually think about what they're doing, and once you lower their inhibitions when it comes to shooting somebody, I think it's not going to really matter whether it's a police officer or a private citizen coming through their door. But would Indiana went a step further, and they basically said that a person who reasonably believes that in their mind that police officers are not acting lawfully when they come through their door can utilize deadly force against those officers. And to me, that's absolutely staggering, and it equates to, you know, open season on cops. You know, we've seen a dramatic increase in the murder of police officers across the country last year, and that trend is continuing, particularly due to gun violence. I think deaths by gun violence were up an astonishing percentage last year over prior years, and that trend is continuing. And, you know, laws like this certainly do us no favors, and it makes a very dangerous job a lot more dangerous.
And the way that you worded that, because I haven't read the Indiana, I'm going off of how you've presented it. The way you worded it with the police officer is you don't think they're acting lawfully. Well, if I'm a drug dealer and you're coming to my door, I don't think you're acting lawfully.
No, it leaves, you know,
I mean,
they still require reasonableness, but, you know, it is a determination. And what people need to understand is if police officers, you know, I've been on the Special Weapons and Tactics team for the better part of 12 years now, and when we do our business, it's because we have a valid search warrant reviewed by a neutral magistrate, a judge, who has issued the search warrant and said, yes, you have probable cause that this crime was committed and that evidence of the crime will be found in the place you're seeking to search, and gives us the authority to do that. What the Indiana law seems to do is really take away that legal determination from the neutral magistrate and give it to the homeowner who more than likely is involved in some sort of criminal activity themselves. It's mind-boggling to me that this would occur.
And how are the? Have you talked to any of the police in some of the other areas? Are you guys working on a way around that? How?
Well,
do you have any?
You know, I think we go into our job knowing that it's dangerous, and but I think if you see laws like that spread, it will certainly change the way police do business in terms of you know, the execution of search warrants and that kind of thing. You know, but it's an evolving body of law, and it's an evolving issue, and I think it really took people by surprise. But I did see recently that at the time the Florida law was signed, the Florida Police Officers Associations did speak out against the Stand Your Ground law. So this is not an issue where the police were promoting these laws or standing silent. They were saying, hey, these laws are going to make our job more dangerous and are not going to result in increased public safety. You're going to have people misusing deadly force in our communities, and we don't believe this is good public policy. It just didn't get a lot of attention at the time, again, because there was so much money available to these lobbying groups that they, you know, they just flooded the airways with these messages of fear and hate and, you know, the need to look out for yourself and you can't count on anybody else to do it and that kind of thing.
And if anyone wants to read this blog or read any of the blogs you write, where can they go?
Yeah, the blog address is COPS, the number 4, labor, .blogspot.com, copsforlabor.blogspot.com, and I've been writing since about January, and there's a talk a little bit about the Wisconsin protests and then some of the issue of money and politics in our society and then issues like this.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for being on today. I'd love to have you on again.
Great. Thanks for
it
having me on, Sarah.
Wonderful. Well, you're welcome, and thank you for explaining all that to us, and I think more people need to hear about it. So thank you
Absolutely.
Very much.
Thanks.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. We're just listening to Brian Austin, and he is obviously the blogger for Cops for Labor. Again, that website's copsforlabor.blogspot.com. Now we're going to go to a quick break, and after the break, we're going to speak to Mike Brown from One Wisconsin Now. You are listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
You know the day destroys the night.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show. Sarah Schultz, we have Mike Brown from One Wisconsin Now. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for being on the show today.
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you're welcome. The phone number to call in is 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896 if you have any questions for Mike, or you can just post them in our chat room. Now, I was going to start out with money being sent in the recall, but I think because we ended with the Castle Doctrine, Alec, I think we should start with Alec, who seems to be our favorite think tank of the day right now.
They have been getting a lot of attention recently, attention that I don't know that they were particularly interested in having.
No, but it's good attention for them to have.
Obviously, their modus operandi has been to try and operate in the shadows for the almost 40 years that they've existed. Little public attention paid to who they are and what they're up to is a good thing.
I agree. Now, they have, like you had mentioned, they've come into the light. They've run into some problems lately of corporations backing out. What's your take on all of that?
Well, I think it's clear that even Alec's agenda has gotten too extreme for some of the major corporations that have underwritten them for years. A coalition nationally has really kicked us off in a vigorous way, asking members of the board of ALEC, why are you on this board? What is the benefit to your corporation for imposing voter ID laws? Or what is the benefit for you for having Castle Doctrine laws enacted around the state? Or what is the benefit for you seeing education privatized in the states? And a number of corporations have responded, I guess we don't know, or in fact that things like that are not consistent with even their corporate agenda, so they've decided to not renew or drop their membership in ALEC.
Well, how many have backed out so far, do you know?
Thus far, as of this morning, and this has been a rising total all through the week, it's Coca-Cola, Pepsi,
McDonald's, Wendy's, Mars, Intuit, Kraft, the Arizona Public Service, which is a utility, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have all publicly indicated that they are no longer supporting or associating themselves with ALEC. So these are not necessarily bastions of liberalism either that are backing out. So I think it does show just how far to the right ALEC has been tilted.
I was going to say, was it McDonald's in there too? Or?
Yep, McDonald's.
Yeah, I don't remember McDonald's being the bastion of liberalism myself. But now, do you think this is the end of ALEC? And why or why not do you think that?
Well, while there have been some high-profile exits from ALEC, there are certainly other major corporations and others, other noted right-wing supporters such as the Koch brothers and the Scaife Foundation that do provide significant support to ALEC. Among their other corporate board members, you know, you've got folks like Walmart, AT&T, ExxonMobil, some of the larger pharmaceutical companies, pharma itself, Altria, which is used to be Philip Morris. Along with the folks like the Koch brothers, there's clearly still some significant resources behind the organization. Now, whether or not it continues on as ALEC or it morphs into something else, or they change the name and try and tell folks there's nothing to see here, that remains to be seen. It has been a model that has been around for a while, and it has certainly benefited some of the corporations that underwrite it. The whole idea behind ALEC is that the corporate members and the lobbyists and other special interests who are associated with it get together and put together model legislation. They basically write their dream bill. What would be the best possible scenario for me to maximize my profits or benefit myself in these various states, and then ALEC as the front group provides scholarships to state legislators, flies them off to a nice resort, takes them out to a baseball game, takes them out for some drinks, and gets them together with these lobbyists and representatives of these corporations, pitches them on the legislation and sends them back home to go pass it. It has, in Wisconsin, proven to, unfortunately, I think for the interests of most of us here, been distressingly successful. ALEC model legislation that we've seen passed in just this last legislative session are things like voter ID, things like Castle Doctrine, the drive towards privatization of public education, anti-healthcare reform bills. So Wisconsin is not participating in healthcare exchanges or attempts to not require insurance companies to spend a minimum percentage of their premium dollars on actually providing people with the care that they're paying for their insurance for. All of this is ALEC-generated legislation, and all of it has moved through the Wisconsin legislature and onto the governor's desk, where ALEC alumni, Governor Scott Walker, has been all too willing to sign into law.
Now, Republicans like to say that Democrats are ALEC members. Who are those Democrats, especially here in Wisconsin?
The only Democratic member of ALEC that I'm aware of is Representative Mark Pocan from Madison, who in the past has gone basically as a undercover agent to ALEC and has reported back to the people of Wisconsin what's been going on at these meetings. The concern is that Republicans in places of significant power are members of ALEC. Both of the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee, for example, Representative Robin Voss and Senator Alberta Darling, are members of ALEC. In fact, Alberta Darling has us, the taxpayers, to thank for paying her ALEC dues. Chairs of the Senate Health Committee, chairs of the Senate Insurance Committee, all of these folks are ALEC members. They are in positions of power and influence with the ability to move legislation, and they are, you know, many of them are thanks to our tax dollars, members of ALEC, and thanks to the corporations that that underwrite ALEC, have had the opportunity for some nice vacations and some nice wining and dining at various locations around the country, and have come back and foisted ALEC's corporate agenda on us.
Well, who are some of the other ALEC members? You mentioned Voss, who is Mr. ALEC. He's the ALEC kind of point person, and Alberta Senator Alberta Darling. Who are some of the other ones?
Well, now in the state Senate, there are 9 current state senators who are having their dues in ALEC paid for by us, and they are Senators Frank Lassay, Alberta Darling, Neil Kedzie, Scott Fitzgerald, Glenn Grothman, Van Wongard, Terry Moulton, Mary Lazich, and Rich Zipperer. And you know, all of these folks, you know, the other interesting thing is that all of these folks have really played critical roles in moving ALEC model legislation. You know, if you want to take a look at it, you know, Frank Lassay has been a leader in fighting to prevent us from having health insurance as chair of the Insurance Committee. Alberta Darling has been a strong advocate for slashing public education and privatizing public education as co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee. Neil Kedzie, as chair of the Environment Committee, has moved horrible environmental legislation in this last session. Scott Fitzgerald, as majority leader, was responsible for putting all of it on the floor. Glenn Grothman, a hero in the war on women with his repeal of equal pay. Van Wongard, who sits on the Telecommunications Committee of ALEC, was instrumental in moving telecom, quote-unquote, reform legislation in Wisconsin. Terry Moulton, as chair of the Business Committee, was responsible for moving several tax giveaways to large corporations. You know, the list goes on and on. Rich Zipperer, as chair of the Judiciary Committee, actually introduced the bill that would have exempted drug and medical device manufacturers from any liability for causing death or injury to people if their drugs or devices were approved by the FDA. A massive shield for corporations from any liability for killing folks.
That's all I have to say about that. How about the representatives? How many of our representatives in the state of Wisconsin are ALEC members?
There are a good number of representatives who are also ALEC members. Most prominently would be Robin Voss, who's co-chair of the Joint Committee on Finance, obviously in a position of great influence in the state assembly. In the event Republicans maintain the majority there, probably your next speaker of the assembly. His right-hand man, Representative Scott Souter, who is the Assembly Majority Leader, is a member of ALEC. You know, other prominent members, Representative Pat Strakota, who serves on the Joint Committee on Finance, is an ALEC member. Representative John Nygren, who is chair of the Assembly Health and Insurance Committee, is a member of ALEC. Noted public education basher Steve Noss is a member of ALEC. You know, the list goes the list goes on and on. There's roughly looks like about 25 or 30 odd members of the state assembly who are ALEC members.
How about Representative Joe Clayfish? Is he a member?
I am scanning my list right here, and I don't see him as identified as an ALEC member, but I don't think you could say he's anything other than an ALEC sympathizer.
Well, he just kind of rubber stamps everything through anyway.
He's able to come up with all kinds of interesting ideas all on his own, I guess.
Well, like the shooting of the Sandhill Cranes and hunting them.
Right. Job creation bills like that.
Exactly. Who needs ALEC? He'll just come up with his own. No problem. Now, I'm going to get out of talking about who's in ALEC to going to the mass amounts of corporations leaving, do you think that I'm looking for the question here. Do you think that's a trend to move away from the extreme opinion media or toxic media?
Well, I would certainly hope that, you know, these corporations would you know, take a look at just what this organization that they are underwriting is doing and the impact it's having on folks. You know, I mean, these are at some very basic level, these corporations still need consumers. They still need a middle class. They need folks who have an opportunity to prosper and succeed, and spend their money at their businesses. You know, but the ALEC agenda is one that I think, as we've seen here in Wisconsin, is not good for middle class and working families. You know, when you see you know, the kind of cuts we've seen here to public education and dollars shifting to unaccountable private voucher schools. You know, you're seeing schools right now are starting to issue, you know, layoff notices to their teachers, and it's their budgets in this next year are going to be horrible, on the backs of you know, some really painful cuts that they already had to make in this last year. You know, larger class sizes, thousands of teachers across the state either retiring or being laid off. You know, cutting course offerings in critical subject areas. You know, I mean, that's a direct direct result of the ALEC agenda, and it's the kind of thing that will hurt middle class consumers. That if businesses took a little bit longer view, you know, they'd realize it's hurting them also.
How will they get that to pass if they pass legislation that suppresses wages?
Well, if you take a look at, you know, some of the legislation that has passed, you know, there is clearly a correlation between levels of education and quality of education and both the ability to earn higher wages and also, interestingly enough, in times where there are, you know, difficult economic times, people with more education on average spend less time on unemployment looking for work. So I think you can, you know, so there's that indirect impact on, you know, if you're looking for a job, or you're earning lower wages, you know, you're not able to, you're not making the kind of living that allows you to say, for example, you know, go out to eat at some point during the week, or you know, buy that new computer that you know, that they're manufacturing and selling, or, you know, I mean, all kinds of other consumer and kind of daily life related activities that that these corporations depend on people spending money in order to survive.
Well, we're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back with Mike Brown from One Wisconsin Now. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my Progressive Point of View, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Finally, the pressure's on ALEC, and I'm not talking about the kid down the street. No, I'm talking about the American Legislative Exchange Council, this group of corporations that gets together to draft and vote on what they call model legislation, and then they hand it off to right-wing legislators to ram through state capitals. Well, after watchdogs publicized ALEC's involvement in the drafting of Stand Your Ground and Castle Doctrine laws that legalize and immunize the kind of vigilantism we saw in the Trayvon Martin case, why, corporate members of ALEC began to feel some heat of their own. Already this month, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Kraft Foods, and Intuit have bowed out of ALEC. Grassroots campaigners are now targeting AT&T, State Farm, Johnson & Johnson, and other major corporations that have been paying ALEC's bills. Other than the NRA and gun manufacturers and ammo providers, it was never clear to me why corporate America was backing the Stand Your Ground laws. They weren't going to make a profit from them, and it wasn't even part of the whole anti-regulation push that ALEC traditionally makes. No, this was something more sinister, more anarchic, and it's too much, even for some corporate executives. I'm Matt Rothschild, And that's how I see it.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show. Sarah Schultz, we're speaking with Mike Brown from One Wisconsin Now. So obviously Matt Rothschild kind of came in with that, his
yep.
own little discussion, what we were talking about. And I've lost all my questions, so how about we continue talking about Alec a little bit more?
Sure, sure. Well, and you know, and I think the important thing to recognize also is that it is, while Alec is a corporate-funded front group, they do need willing partners at the state legislative level in order to advance their agenda. So it's obviously an important national campaign that people are waging, and they're having some success. They've drawn a lot of attention to Alec, and they are getting some of the major corporations underwriting Alec to publicly disavow the organization. We're asking here also that, you know, people put some pressure on their state legislators who have been willing accomplices, if you will, in this scheme, and ask them to dump Alec also. Because it doesn't work if there aren't legislators back here in Wisconsin who have been wined and dined thanks to these special interests and are pushing out legislation that turns around and benefits them.
Now, are media people such as the right wing talkers out of Milwaukee or Madison's radio folks members at all?
Private members of Alec, you know. We have some information that has been revealed. Basically, their board of directors and through some other indirect means, there's been the ability to determine who some of the private sector members of the organization are. They have publicly available members of some of their task forces, and through open records, we're able to determine. Here in Wisconsin, who's having taxpayers pay their dues, and who is, based on schedules, who's traveling to Alec conferences. But some of the private members, we're not going to be able to really find that information easily. It's either going to be through leaked internal documents or other investigations, or people, willingly coming out and saying they're a member of Alec. I don't know if Journal Communications is in this environment going to come out and say that they're proud members of Alec. Quite honestly, in terms of talk radio and some of the other, the right wing noise machine. I mean, clearly you have great sympathy for the corporate agenda from folks like your Charlie Sykes or Mark Belling or Vicki McKenna here in Madison. I know Bill O'Reilly on Fox News was just last night decrying the campaign of intimidation against these poor oppressed corporations who are members of Alec. So there's obviously if not membership complicity in pushing the agenda by the right wing media noise machine.
Well, and they're very good at it.
They do seem to coalesce around a set of talking points remarkably quickly at all levels of media, national and local, and just continue to hammer on the same theme. But I think the good news here is that the agenda of Alec is being dragged out here in the open. Citizens are getting activated. They're contacting these corporations and encouraging them to drop Alec. They're contacting their state legislators and encouraging them to dump their membership in Alec. And I think there's something going on here nationally in Wisconsin. There are a lot of people who are getting engaged in this who are standing up for themselves, saying, "I want you to be on my side instead of the side of the corporations."
And it's about time that started happening, and it's good to see the pushback by all these groups that are doing that, because a lot of these Alec bills are, they tend to hit the people of color more than they would others. There's a background, almost racism to some of these.
I think, you know, certainly when you look at events nationally and also even here in Wisconsin, you know, the quote unquote stand your ground or Castle Doctrine bills have had a tragic impact on members of the minority community. When you look at other model legislation like you know, the quote unquote voter ID or voter suppression legislation, you know, there's a lot of research out there that shows that the impact of that is dramatically and disproportionately on minorities and also seniors and students, you know, making access to the most basic right of a democracy, the right to vote, much more difficult for those targeted populations.
Now, we have a couple minutes left, so I want to go into the elections a little bit, the recall elections. I wanted to touch on your thoughts on the fake Dem running. What do you feel? What do you think about that?
Sure. Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is there's basically been a situation created where you have candidates filing false information that misleads the public, but also the regulatory agency that's in charge of enforcing our election laws. You know, in order to get on the ballot, you have to file certain forms with the Government Accountability Board. And one of those forms is called a Declaration of Candidacy. That is a sworn statement that you make. It's a notarized statement that you have to submit to the Government Accountability Board. You provide your name, you say the office you're running for, but you also have to indicate which party you intend to, quote-unquote, represent. These fake candidates have indicated in the last round of recalls last summer and again this time that they intend to represent the Democratic Party. Yet they have publicly stated, the Republican Party of Wisconsin has publicly stated, these candidates have said it in, you know, campaign literature that they authorized and paid for by, that the reason for their candidacy is to benefit politically the Republican Party. You have a situation where these two things simply cannot be true at the same time. You cannot be representing the Democratic Party while you are running in order to politically benefit the Republican Party of Wisconsin. You know, you can argue about whether or not we have an open primary system and people should be able to run for office. They don't have to subscribe to a party ideology in order to claim that they're running, you know, as a member of the Democratic or Republican Party. But this crosses a line. These people are clearly not accurately or truthfully representing their intention in this election and who they are representing. And on that basis, One Wisconsin Now has asked the Government Accountability Board to investigate these folks. We've also provided the information to local district attorneys asking them to investigate it because filing a false campaign declaration of candidacy form with the Government Accountability Board is a Class I felony. And we would hope that, you know, in the interest of honest and transparent elections, that regulators and law enforcement take this seriously. People are, we believe, violating the law based on a long record of evidence. And in order to just ensure that, you know, as we move forward, that we're going to have honest and open elections, you know, we have rules in place. And if those rules are broken, we believe they ought to be enforced.
Well, I know Levinson wrote a complaint to the GAB about it.
Yes.
Where do you think that's going to go?
As I understand it, he has filed information with the Government Accountability Board and has indicated that it's his intention to challenge the ballot status of the upcoming of the fake candidates in the upcoming recall elections based on their filing of false declarations of candidacy, but also, you know, when you're misrepresenting yourself as a declared candidate, you're also misrepresenting yourself when you file your nomination papers, which are necessary in order to gain ballot access. You know, you basically, the argument is that you have committed fraud on the folks who signed your nomination papers, and that you have submitted invalid papers to the to the Government Accountability Board. You know, when you go out and you circulate your nomination papers, you have your name and the party that you're representing on that nomination paper. So someone who would like to have a Democrat on the ballot running against a Republican in the upcoming recall elections has basically had their ability to actually have a Democrat on the ballot taken away from them by being essentially tricked into signing the nomination papers of these fake candidates, because you can only sign one person's nomination paper candidate. They would not be able to also sign the nomination paper of a real Democrat at some future point. So, it's both that the basic idea underlying Attorney Levinson's complaint is that these folks have fraudulently represented themselves to the voters and ought not be rewarded by having a place on the ballot.
Now, does that cover all the fake Democrats? Does this have to go county to county, such as Jefferson with Mr. Ellerman running against Lori Compass?
No, the complaint before the Government Accountability Board is asking that none of the fake candidates. That would include, the Republicans who are running as Democrats, both for lieutenant governor and governor, but also in the four Senate recalls. So that would be. That would be Mr. Ellerman, who organized the Walkers for Walker in Lake Mills and is a noted Republican Party activist and has publicly identified himself as having a conservative Republican worldview. That would include asking him to not be allowed to run as a Democrat in the upcoming election, right?
Well, and he's come out and said even that that the GOP asked him to run, and he said okay.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, and
that's in the paper.
And that's really the breathtaking thing about this, and this is really where the line has been crossed. I mean, the Republican Party and these candidates have just been brazen about the fact that they are misrepresenting themselves on the forms that they have filed with the GAB in order to gain ballot access. They have misrepresented themselves in order to politically advantage the Republican Party of Wisconsin and Republican candidates.
And if people want more information, where can they go to get that?
Well, in terms of the ballot access issues, that's going to be decided by the Government Accountability Board. I believe they have a hearing scheduled for next Tuesday. If you would like more information on the fake candidates, we have some information posted on our website, and that's onewisconsinnow.org.
All one word?
Yes.
Okay, onewisconsinnow.org. Mike, thank you so much for being on today.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
I appreciate it. We'll definitely have you back on again to talk more about stuff. Maybe we'll wait until after hear what the GAB says and maybe get you back on to talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. Be happy to do it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot. You too.
Welcome. Thanks.
Bye.
That was Mike Brown with One Wisconsin Now. And again, the website is onewisconsinnow.org. And then we'll be right back. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. Oh, we'll have some breaking news as well.
Pick up my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees.
Shut it down, left town. Now it's the unemployment line. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business for me to be involved in. I'm slinging greasy burgers, kitchen 99 degrees. Scrub the floor, wash that door. May I take your order, please? Ah, too much monkey business. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Comes salesman thinks he's got me on the rope. Says the secret to enlightenment is vitamins and soap. Aw, too much monkey business. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business for me to be involved in. When I got my education, had to borrow 30 grand. Now no one wants my resume.
Supply exceeds demand.
I also changed my name, Dirty Clothes.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz. We are speaking with Scott Wyckoff now. He is with Badger Democracy. But before I get there, I'm going to read to you what was released by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin on John Doe. So I'm just reading off their website. If you want more information on it, please go to withdems.org. Again, it's withdems.org. And they say that there's the new research obtained by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin reveals that Scott Walker alone was responsible for the hire and promotion of Tim Russell and Kerry Reitfleisch, two key figures in the John Doe criminal corruption probe that has to date charged six close Walker aides and supporters with 15 felonies, resulted in two convictions, required Scott Walker himself to establish a criminal defense fund. They said that personal records obtained through the open records request from Milwaukee County Department shows Scott Walker was solely responsible for hiring them, Kelly Reinspice and Tim Russell, and for their subsequent promotions to increasingly trusted, responsible, and lucrative positions in the Walker administration. So, again, more information, go to withdems.org. They have links to some of these requests that they've gotten back. So, good morning, Scott.
Good morning. That's an interesting piece of news, isn't it?
Isn't it great? An interesting Friday.
Well, and you know, so Scott Walker can't say anymore that he didn't know anything about the hiring of Tim Russell or Kerry Reinspice because his name was signed on the dotted line of the in the Human Resources Department of Milwaukee County. So he was responsible for hiring and. For prognosticators looking at this, you have to look at what Tom Nardelli did and start wondering if Tom Nardelli didn't see the writing on the wall and think that he was going to be, hung out to dry by the Walker administration, and he blew the whistle before that had an opportunity to happen, 2 years ago when this whole thing started. So. And I love the response by the Milwaukee County DA to the ridiculous request of private practice attorney Paul Bucher to have the Department of Justice step take over the John Doe investigation. He had a great response, basically saying he's had federal cooperation. The DOJ had their opportunity to assist in the investigation, and they refused early on. So, any thought that this was a partisan process is completely fictitious. So, the panic attack has started, and I think we're going to be seeing something, come out of this very soon. Just the whole reaction of by the extreme right wing is seeming to signal that something's coming down the line, and they know it, they feel it. So it's going to be an interesting 2 months before the recall election.
It is, isn't it? Well, do you feel that what they released is the truth, a lie? Are they stretching it? I mean, they've got links to their open records request.
Well, the information that they're saying has actually been known for a couple of weeks. Those were emails released a couple of weeks ago that indicated that Reinfleisch and Russell's hire were, Walker's, that he had the final okay on their hiring, and that he was, in fact, responsible for them even coming into the, into county government. And if you look at Tim Russell's record, he was fired from a state job for misappropriation of funds and gross negligence. So under normal circumstances, he would have never obtained a county position. They would have done a background check on him and a previous employment check through the state of Wisconsin, and he would have never been hired. So it would have taken Walker's intervention to even get him a position in county government, much less the influential position he was in. So, without a doubt, this is factual information. It's the result of an open records request. The emails are there for everybody to see. The documents obtained by Milwaukee County are there for everybody to see. So this is not a partisan issue by any means. This is a factual hiring practice that Scott Walker engaged in. He did it at the county. We've seen it at the state level. And this is going to, of course, bring things much, much closer to Scott Walker. And, and one thing that is a rumor, of course, that last week Politiscoop, not the most reliable source, reported that Walker was seen at the federal courthouse in Milwaukee. How much that's true, I don't know. But, you know, the facts as we have them, who his counsel is, this is one level removed from his direct authority. You don't need to be Perry Mason to connect the dots in this case. It's a matter of the DA lining up the facts and the individuals and the chain of events and, linking them to whoever John Doe is. And it's looking more and more likely like it's Scott Walker.
Well, what's the repercussions for any of this for the Senate recall elections?
Well, it makes Scott Walker toxic, obviously, for any of the state senators facing recall. They need to distance themselves from Scott Walker and his policies, and that's, under the voting record from this last session, it's something that's virtually impossible for them to do. The Republican senators had every opportunity in the second half of the legislative session to mediate with the Democrats to start looking at some of the actual job legislation that had been forwarded and authored and presented to committee, and they ignored every bit of it. And we saw at the end of the session, instead they went and jammed all this social engineering, anti-women's rights, anti-women's health legislation down the throats of the people of Wisconsin, in spite of every opportunity to respond to this recall movement and do what Dale Schultz did and come to some sort of middle ground here. And by and large, the people that are involved in the recall refuse to do that. And even went further to the extreme. So, they're going to have a hard time convincing, moderate voters in their district that they represent the best interests of the people of their districts.
Well, especially since they just ran through anything that Walker wanted to be put through.
Right. And we see this strange paradox of, I've had some people that are involved in, very deeply in the Senate tell me that there was open rebellion in some instances against the Fitzgerald brothers at the end of the session by Republican senators who felt like they've been hung out to dry. And it's really interesting because we saw that with the mining bill and the school voucher, the special needs voucher legislation, that those were key pieces of legislation that Walker and the Fitzgeralds et al. Wanted, and they didn't get. Much of what happened in the Senate is responsible for that. They passed the assembly, but they didn't have the votes in the Senate, and they didn't even bring it up for a vote. They referred them both back to committee, where they died at the end of the session, to avoid the embarrassment of, not having the votes. And it's an interesting dynamic, because that split happened at the end, and there are some moderate Republican senators that the Fitzgerald brothers and Scott Walker's administration really didn't know where their vote was going to go, so they didn't even bother bringing up the vote. And in fact, it's interesting, there was a piece of legislation that didn't get a lot of play that dealt with some fiscal issues, and a Republican senator, Senator Coles, actually introduced an amendment that gutted what the Republicans wanted, and it virtually killed the bill, and they referred it back to committee. And I don't have the bill number in front of me, but I was actually talking to Senator Vinehout about it a couple weeks ago. And she pointed out that was one bill that didn't get any play in the media, but it was a key fiscal piece that they wanted put in, and one of their own introduced an amendment to gut it, and it died. So there's some really, because of the recalls and the power of this grassroots movement, there's a lot of interesting dynamics at play, and I would not guarantee that if we take the Senate back to the recalls and hold it in the November election, which is, again, that's not guaranteed because of the redistricting, I don't know that the Assembly is necessarily going to be as extremist as they were this session, because there has been a lot of blowback in these districts, and there's a lot of strong Dems running against normally safe Republicans. And I would not be surprised to see the Assembly come a little bit further to the middle if the Republicans hold it, which is likely they will, but less of a majority and not so extreme, especially if one of the Democratic candidates beats Walker in the recall and the Senate is lost back to the Democratic Party and progresses. It's going to be a very interesting dynamic. So it's going to be a very interesting year.
It will be. It definitely will be. Now, how closely tied are the Fitzgerald brothers to Walker?
Well, very, very close. I mean, even if you look back at Walker's legislative days when he was in ALEC, the Fitzgeralds are intimately involved in ALEC. And, of course, they went lockstep with each other into the abyss of Act 10 and the budget repair bill and, you know, all these other, the governor's special session on jobs, which was social reengineering. All those things had to be scheduled and brought to the floor and into the committee, by the leaders, which are the Fitzgeralds. Nothing that Scott Walker accomplished could have been done without the Fitzgerald brothers, because everything had to go through the legislature, and nothing would have gone through the legislature without the two of them being arm in arm with Scott Walker.
Do you think the John Doe investigation will connect the Fitzgerald brothers to him? Or you think that's something separate because that started in Milwaukee County?
Well, it's part of Milwaukee County. There's not going to be a connection directly with what Walker did as county executive. The broader connection is ideological and philosophical. And, again, the execution of Act 10 and all these other power grabs, Act 21, which was actually discussed in the debate with all the candidates, the Dane Dems debate that was held this week. Was Act 21 was actually brought up in that debate, and it's the extreme power grab and rulemaking by Governor Walker. Well, that had to happen with legislative consent. It was the legislature, through the leadership of Fitzgerald, giving up one of their checks and balances over the governor. So those things are what links Scott Walker, and hopefully that will be the focus of Lori Compass's campaign, is on the connection of Scott Fitzgerald and Scott Walker, and that Walker gets nothing without Scott Fitzgerald. The governor can't make law, and the governor can suggest, can introduce budget, can do all these things, but the governor cannot make law. And that's the connection of the Fitzgeralds. It's so strong in this recall election.
Now, getting to the recall elections and Democratic candidates. I know we have about 6 minutes left, 7 minutes
okay.
left. But your latest blog is about the Democratic candidates and the need to maintain the grassroots identity with this process. Do you feel that the voice of the grassroots has been lost in this?
I don't think it's been lost. I think it's threatened. I mean, the reason I wrote the blog and then I've been subsequently, I've done interviews with three of the four candidates. I'll be doing an interview with Mayor Barrett within the next few days, and I'm hoping to get Nayla Mitchell as well. But, you know, we have four very distinct candidates, and I think it's tragic that in the mainstream media, this has become a two-person race. It's become Barrett versus Paul. And if your listeners go to WIFI, they have the archived video of the debate from Wednesday night. I believe it was Wednesday night, the Dane County Dems. And it is worth listening to every moment of that debate because every candidate has something brilliant to say. And every candidate has, you know, a certain viewpoint, and without a doubt, any of those candidates will be a better governor than Scott Walker and will move us forward to progressive values that Wisconsin wants to represent. So, that being said, there is a danger that when the recall is over, win or lose, that the energy and momentum of this movement will wane, or worse yet, it could be hijacked. Because the grassroots movement that has happened has done something that no party has been able to do, and that is coalesce an intense grassroots movement around the state with the goal of recalling a sitting governor. No Labor Party, no Republican, Democratic Party, no union could have dreamt of this happening. And the concern that I voiced was that we need to keep our eye on the fact that this is a bigger issue than Scott Walker. That all these things that we've seen, collective bargaining attacks, attacks on labor, dividing the middle class, and health cuts, public education cuts, attacks on women, women's health attacks, all these issues that have happened, attacks on the environment, rolling back environmental standards, these are all symptoms of a much greater issue. And, you know, basically what I'm hoping people will focus on beyond the recall, no matter what the outcome is, that we still have much to accomplish. Because right now, the rights of most of the people in this state and in this country are being trampled by the powerful few. And this is a war for the recovery of deliberative democracy and representation in this state and nation. And that's what this movement in Wisconsin represents, and which is why it's critical for us to succeed not only this fall, but to continue moving forward in that direction.
Do you feel that if one of the candidates that aren't seen as a grassroots candidate will actually turn away the grassroots people and they just won't come out to vote, or do they understand that this is a bigger issue than just that candidate and that the stakes are high enough that it won't matter and they'll just go behind whoever ends up being the candidate, the Democratic candidate?
Well, without a doubt, they all have their talking points to the grassroots and the recall movement very well established. So, you know, one has to look at records, you know, which is why I'm glad that the other candidates did not sign Tom Barrett's ridiculous pledge, because this has to be, it has to be a civil and respectful debate, but it must be contentious, because there are significant differences in records with all these candidates and how they would approach their service to the people as governor. And it's, you know, it's not apparent how this is all going to play out. And no matter who wins, we can't, you know, look and say, okay, we've taken back the governorship, so-and-so is governor now, so all is right with the world. That's not the case, because, for example, legislation. It used to be that people would go to their legislator and say, we have a problem with X, with water quality, safety, or something. The legislators, they would establish a committee, they would get together, they would author legislation on behalf of the people of their district. No more does that happen. Legislation now is being authored by high-priced paid lobbyists, by corporations, through groups like ALEC, through conservative think tanks, and they are spoon-fed to legislators that are responding to their paid interests. We need to change that. This movement needs to turn it around and have legislation that is authored on behalf of the people. And when you look at the first line of a piece of legislation in Wisconsin, it says, the people of Wisconsin, duly represented, hereby enact. That's been lost. And that's what we need to regain. And collective bargaining is a big part of that, because collective bargaining is a way for the majority who do not have control of capital to have a place at the table to bargain for, you know, workplace rights and quality of the workplace and pay and benefits with the people that control capital. And that's been flipped upside down as well. Capital is now being seen as superior to labor. And even Abraham Lincoln, in his first State of the Union address, said that labor must be maintained as superior to capital. And that's been flipped. So we have a lot of work to do regardless of the outcome of this recall. And if we keep our eye on that issue and respectfully vet each candidate and let the people choose a candidate, then we will defeat Scott Walker. But further than that, we will begin taking back small-d democracy, regardless of who's in office.
Scott, thank you so much for being on today. What's your website, real quick, for people to go and read more about your blogs?
If they just do a search on Badger Democracy, that would be the easiest. Kind of, but it's www.bdgrdemocracy.wordpress.com.
Okay. And hopefully we'll get you on next week, but thank you so much. And actually, if you could be on hold real fast, Bill will speak to you for just a second, okay?
Sounds great. Have a great weekend, right. And solidarity, everybody.
Thanks. You too, Scott. Well, we are done with the show for this week. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for his hard work in the show. I'd like to thank you all for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. The music you heard today was from Ann Feeney and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I'll have their links to their website on my Facebook page. You can listen to the show from iTunes or blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz, or you can listen off the Sarah Schultz Show Android phones and iPhones app. There we go. I was just looking for that. You can also tune in Saturday at 6 p.m. to WIDE 99.1. Tuesday at 1 p.m. to WHYS, and on Sundays at 8 a.m. to WFAQ. Thank you so much for listening again. Remember, Wisconsin, one day longer, one day stronger. Let's keep up the fight. Have a great week, everyone.